What is happening? Welcome to another episode of the On the Corner podcast. My name is Nick Pollock, and today we have Nate Schwartz coming and joining me. Get out of here, Eric Samolsky, because we got to do a mock draft in review. Nate, tell everybody who you are and what you're doing here.
Yeah, so I'm Nate Schwartz. I've been writing at PitcherList for almost 4 years now. Woo! Time flies. Really does. Doing mostly going deep stuff, you know, looking deep into kind of all analytics from the player stuff to the kind of more retrospective league-wide stuff. I, you know, helped write the Process Plus article on the stat that Kyle Bland developed.
Won an FSWA for your writing there, Nate?
Yes. Yeah, it was a FSWA award-winning article, which was really neat. And I've just kind of been, you know, all about, you know, looking deeper, telling the data-driven stories in baseball and fantasy baseball over the last several years.
And you're going to see more of him this year.
Oh, yeah.
I promise everyone here. So we wanted to make sure that Nate was a part of this draft. And if you don't remember, we did a mock draft in the beginning, middle of October. And it has been a busy time. So I haven't been able to seize this man until right now. To do this draft on a late Thursday night, right after Johan Oviedo got traded to the Red Sox, and I was able to do a Moneyball meme with it because he throws with a great extension and height-adjusted VAA, but he can't throw strikes. We'll see what happens there. But remember that this is a 12-teamer. We have three outfielders, not five. No middle infielder, no corner infielder, two utility spots, and it's head-to-head focus in Yahoo leagues, okay? So this is a shallow league. We do this every year, just get a good understanding of the generalized ADP, especially for your 10-12 teamers, where the NFBC ADP, that is the 15-team leagues, don't apply as much. So we love getting this good glimpse at it. And yes, there are going to be some picks here that are a little bit outdated. I'm so sorry for Eric Samolsky with his sixth round, Carlos Rodon. Yes, we know that's not where he's going to go. And Amai, once he signs, is not going to be there. Blah, blah, blah. I'm done saying all this stuff. You know it. Check out the draft in the show notes. And Nate, you had pick number three. Did you select this one and want this going into it?
Yes, I did.
And why?
A bunch of my drafts in 2025 where I was really selecting kind of at the turn a lot later, and I didn't get a chance to grab any of the elite talent. And I think when I was signing up for picks, I had the option of, I think, 2 through 4 and a bunch of the later ones. And I didn't really want to make the decision between Judge or Ohtani. But I wanted top talent. And I was like, I'll take three and let myself think about, am I going to go Soto or Witt? And that eventually, you know, led me to Soto.
There you go. And I mean, Juan Soto, pretty straightforward, guys. I'm not going to bore you with all the analysis of Soto stealing more bases than we expected. He should still be a very major part of that lineup with the Mets and so on. We can move past that. I will say, now that you've been at pick number three, do you like that spot as it plays out for the rest of the draft, Nate?
I think so. I realized a little bit later in the draft that some of the pitching, the kind of low SP1, high SP2, where us PitcherList drafters love to sit. I noticed it did kind of get thin in this draft in terms of our options. And I know that I did miss a few guys where I'm like, oh, like, I don't think I would have jumped on him the round before either, which was a little frustrating. But overall, I was pretty happy with what was available to me for most of the draft.
Nice. Well, let's keep going there. Speaking of SP1, too, well, you got my SP2. That is actually, no, I think it's my SP1. Yeah, he is. Garrett Crochet. I got to remember what I did. I don't remember. It is Garrett Crochet. Why? For me, it's because it's a good win situation and strikeouts and just all of it, while there is possibly a negative for Tarek or Skeens, that Crochet just has all the good stuff. Is that how you feel with Crochet? I mean, you really can't go wrong with 1, 2, 3, but do you have Crochet ahead of the others?
I mean, he's on equal footing. I kind of agree with you that he does everything just well enough, and he doesn't have the kind of the volume questions that I think the others do. And you saw in the playoff starts, he was still sitting a tick up. Velocity was holding throughout the start after throwing whatever 210 something innings. Like,
yeah,
you know, he's a workhorse and really just he added the sinker and was throwing it more and more throughout the year. And it's like, this guy has developed and developed and can't do a thing wrong. And frankly, I was shocked that he even made it back to my second round slot. I was convinced he was going to go kind of close to Skeens and Skubal, you know, earlier, either, you know, earlier in the second or late first. And as I'm a pitcherless drafter, I like to wait on pitching, but I could not pass up, you know, a tier 1A starting pitcher in the late second.
Right. It's really tough to determine, especially in the first draft, like how is it going to land? How am I going to feel in those 6, 7, 8 rounds with going a starter over a hitter? And sometimes you can get really fortunate with still getting that last really good hitter before the cliff of it. And that is when, you know, you'd say, okay, cool, I'd go for Crochet. And that'd be great if I get that really good 6th, 7th round hitter to pair with. But then if it gets a little drier, then you might not feel okay with it. And we'll see how that one pans out. But I love your 3rd round pick. And I was kind of upset at myself that I didn't do it. I went Trey Turner in the 2nd. And you went Ketel Marte in the 3rd. I was really hoping you would come back around because second base is so shallow, Nate.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at the options. I was thinking about taking a Devers or maybe a Machado or something to clear up third base, which we'll get to. But Marte's still sitting there. He's by far the best second baseman. I think the next second baseman was Bryce Terang. And, you know, he obviously provides a different skill set, but it's just he's in a different stratosphere compared to the rest of second base. And I'll take my odds with his injury proneness because he clears, you know, clears the group when healthy. He still posts. And I think he even set a new max EV last year. So It's clear the aging isn't really there yet for him. So I'm all in and will gladly take the best at a position.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I, especially in a 12 teamer, I'm very much about getting best in slot as much as you can, or at least just getting something where you don't feel like you're tinkering with it for hitters. I mean, no surprise. I don't want to think about hitters in season. So Ketel Marte is certainly one of those where it's just, yeah, you're going to have him at second. And I know personally, like, I'm going to have to figure this out and I don't want to in season. I could see Ketel Marte going earlier on, middle, second. There's also Jazz Chisholm, I should say, who I believe still has second base eligibility. He might not. In Yahoo, I really should know that hosting this podcast right now, who did go at the end of the 2nd round. So it's not necessarily the only second baseman possibly, but for many leagues he will be the top one, and then it's really just nothing else. So I consider that Matt Olson is your 4th round pick, and I love this one too. I think first base also isn't the fullest it's been in previous seasons, and Olson has been absurdly consistent.
Yeah, I mean, it really felt like the last kind of top tier first baseman. And I really think, especially with first base, you can't miss the cliff because getting that hole in your production from first base where you're, you know, hopefully looking at 200 or so runs in RBI, like a good homer total, like you can't miss out on that if you're trying to, you know, take a shot on someone. And he's been so consistent, had a really nice bounce back in 2025. I know, I think a lot of people maybe thought that the aging or injuries were going to get to him the year before. And then the Atlanta lineup still looks really, really solid. I think they'll be a pretty good offense next year. And I think he'll, you know, he'll slot right in and be a consistent contributor.
Yeah. Remember that Austin Riley should be much better for the entirety of the season, right? Injury removed and just being better. Ronald Acuna was also not great at the beginning of the year as he was out. You have just a better lineup, as you're mentioning, so that should help out Olson. I like both of those two picks. I will say that Marte does get a seal of approval from me. Olson could be right around there. I mean, Vinny Pascantino, I think, is a good one also in the middle of the 5th, so I can't quite say that, but
I will say that I was eyeing Brian Wu here. You know, I was I was not ready to go pitcher heavy to start. And then he kept kind of falling. I think Chris Sanchez went before him. I'm like, if I can end up with, probably my favorite hitter in Soto, a best in class second baseman, and two of my top, I think, five starting pitchers through four rounds, I can't complain. But, it allowed me to make the pivot where I wasn't in this, completely unexpected situation.
Right. And yeah, Brian Wu would have been he was drafted as the seventh overall starting pitcher. Logan Gilbert went right after him as eighth. And then it was your pick with Matt Olson. So coming back around, you didn't go to DeGrom or Sale or Reagan's, Hunter Green, etc. No, you went Wyatt Langford. Why'd you go Wyatt Langford in the fifth?
I really wanted another bat. I think I still had a little bit of cover taking Crochet as an SP1, where I'm like, I think I can keep waiting, keep pushing it down. I think I ended up pushing it down maybe a little bit too far. But I really love Langford's skill set. When I was looking at this and what I had kind of written down when I made the selection was that he had the highest barrel rate of anyone not to hit 25 homers this year. He hit enough pulled fly balls. He has the scary kind of injury history with his oblique, but I really think there's a profile in there for him to go like 40-20 with a .250 batting average. And I don't think it's, his floor is going to crater out. It might be the 2020 with a .220 average that we saw this year. And I'll take my shot at that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Wyatt Langford inside a Texas lineup where he's going to be batting second, third. I mean, he was batting second by the end of the year. Consistently. And it's one of those cases where we knew he was great and we could easily continue to see an ascension from Wyatt Langford across his third full season, actually exactly 134 games for his first two seasons. It's kind of interesting. Sixth round, you needed a shortstop. And should we really be going for Jeremy Peña in the sixth round, Nate?
So I don't know. That's the fun about doing a mock in the middle of October. I was between him and Joe Ryan. And I think in perfect hindsight, knowing how the draft went down, I would have gone with Joe Ryan. Just because I feel like that skill set is really, really, safe. And I really like him, depending on where he's pitching next year. But I really like his skill set. And I think he can provide that kind of low SP1, high SP2 that... doesn't necessarily fulfill, the fastball velocity and the flashiness of it doesn't, I think, get a lot of people on draft boards. But I went with Jeremy Peña. I wanted a big time average guy, especially with the volatility of Soto's average. Langford will be hit or miss. And PLV loves Jeremy Peña's contact ability. He has 2020 potential. He's hitting leadoff full-time in that Astros lineup most likely. And I think he'll just be a really, really complete player that will, do enough for me to fulfill the shortstop position.
Yeah, so last year, Jeremy Peña had at 17 home runs, 20 stolen bases, 3.04 average, across about 550 plate appearances. And one of the benefits is you are going to get someone right at the top of the Astros lineup was hitting first, at the very least by the end of the season, if not from a lot of the season. It was pretty much in April where he wasn't until April 27th. And they said, yeah, let's just try in the leadoff spot, and then just never left. And I see Jeremy Peña as, I don't want to say a Toby of hitters, maybe like a Holly. Like, you're not going to drop Jeremy Peña in all likelihood. At the same time, he is someone that does benefit your 15 teamers more, especially your roto leagues, where you want to have more padding with both average and with stolen bases. Also, I'm not completely sold that the batting average is here to stay. It's better and that's good, but it is a 345 BABIP, and I hate saying this. I feel like I'm better than just quoting BABIP, but his process plus is not that good. It hovered around 110 throughout the year. It's fueled by contact, which will promote average, absolutely. And he doesn't make the best decisions. They're below average. He had above average power by the end. Essentially what it looks like, if you look at the rolling chart, that Jeremy Peña was going through an injury, I guess, for the first 3 months, played through it, took a month off, and then power returned. It was about 90 power plus, and then it was 110, 115 in those final 2 months. So maybe there is something to that that you can lean into. And it really comes down to, all right, who else are the options at shortstop? Jacob Wilson, Geraldo Perdomo. Are you feeling, or Neil Cruz, I should say, are you feeling that knowing where the other guys landed, Wilson in the ninth, Perdomo in the 10th, O'Neill Cruz in the 11th, that you'd still like to have Peña sixth or even seventh round?
Yeah, I think it might have been a little bit aggressive. As I mentioned before, I'd kind of wish I had pivoted to my second starting pitcher there. But I'm a fan of the tool set. And I think the biggest thing for me that I learned from my drafts this year was that I really whiffed on a handful of my, you know, like rounds 5 to 10 hitters. Mm. I kind of dreamed too much on skills and didn't take consistent production. Or, you know, I think I sold out, you know, a little bit too much into guys who were high power, low contact, and, you know, mostly decision making that didn't pan out. And I would think I was really frustrated by the lack of output early in the year. And I think by taking a safe guy like this, it really gives me a strong floor to then take shots in the, you know, in the 10 to 15 range where there's more, you know, fringier options, but, you know, those guys are more easily, you know, moved on from if the situation necessitates.
What is it about us as humans getting older and just being content with what we have, you know,
yeah.
And no longer needing the thrill and the excitement of the big thing and just be like, no, it's probably better if I don't do that.
Yeah. In year six of playing fantasy, you know, I've reached old age and I'm like, give me the Tobys, the hitters.
I'm the one shouting that Tobys are upside too, you know? Oh gosh. We're going to go to the seventh round now, but before we do, we're going to take a quick break. Seventh round, and you got Andrés Muñoz because you missed out on Joe Ryan. Joe Ryan went to the beginning of the round to Eino Saris. You might know him. And Muñoz is right there. He is the third closer off the board. Edwin Diaz and Mason Miller going earlier. I'm not against the seventh, eighth, ninth round closer play. I want to hear from you why you pivoted instead of that Joe Ryan pick to go with, or to go instead of, say, Kyle Bradish or Shane Bieber, Jacob Mizorowski, pitchers who went after, instead to go with Muñoz.
Yeah, so I was having seen Edwin Diaz go in the fifth and then Mason Miller in the sixth. I was really worried that there was going to be a run of closers coming up as we hit the seventh or eighth turn that I was going to miss out on. And having just lost my main option, and I wasn't huge on going for Bradish or, more importantly, I think Mizorowski, I was like, I'll take the shot on a closer. I'll get the guy that I like. And as it turned out, there was not a closer run, which was a little bit frustrating. I think I probably could have taken Muñoz around later. But, you know, I'm happy to pay up a little bit because saves are really so fickle. And getting a top line option, I think, is really important. And I'll take the chance. I really like, you know, I like the role, and, you know, pitching in Seattle always helps.
It is also interesting drafting in October for closers. It's one of the things I think is the worst part about doing these mocks, because it does set ADP too. And that's another really annoying part of this. So you will see closers who are assured in September and October, favored more so than the newer guy who is also assured, or the free agent signing, or someone relieved just because they weren't necessarily locked into that role before. They're going to be lower in ADP, but it becomes pretty clear quickly that they are the closer, and those guys become a huge, huge value oftentimes in drafts when you come around to March or February even. And Duran went after, and then really the closing run that you were trying to predict happened around the ninth. It was Hader Araldis and Kate at the second half of it. And I really weren't too many to choose from.
Yeah,
so,
and I think Munoz. I like Munoz over that kind Munoz of trio. Yeah. I know Rick Graham's reliever rankings were not as kind to Munoz. I think he had him sixth or seventh.
So but, you were the piece of mail that he got.
Yeah.
Okay. Just want to make sure.
Yeah, I was the one who was like, no, I can't keep Munoz this high if Nate's taking him as the third closer off the board.
Yes.
But he lost some velo in the second half of the year, but also was fine. So as long as he's really in the, you know, the upper 90s and still has the slider, I'm just not worried. It's such a good combination that, and it looks like Seattle will still be in winning ball games. So I think it'll be fine to take him here.
Yeah, the losing velocity is always going to make me worry a little bit, especially when Munoz was playing some very important games for the Mariners. It wasn't like, okay, cool, I can take my foot off the gas pedal. And maybe that led to extra fatigue, which can worry. I will always tell people that when you see a closer who still has a role after having a bad season, go after him because reliever ratios are so finicky. They are so, so finicky. It's such a small sample. It's bonkers. So, yeah, I mean, the velocity is a little worrisome hearing that from you right now, but I'm not going to say anything more. Eury Pérez in the eighth round. And I love me some Eury Pérez. I imagine you do too.
Yeah, this was my first, it felt like, fun pick of the draft. I love Eury. I think the biggest thing for him is that he has the fastball, right? I think for a lot of guys, and we saw it, you know, with Strider coming back from TJ, you know, the fastball didn't have the oomph that it once did, and he lost a lot of the shine. Eury comes out and is just dominating with the fastball. And, I mean, one of the things I was looking at is in our mistake rate versus non-competitive rate. So, you know, how many pitches are you throwing that aren't mistakes and are competitive? His fastball is top 20 or top 10 among, you know, all fastballs thrown at least 250 times. You know, that is the elite of the elite. It gets whiffs. Hitters don't do much to it. And he throws it in the zone all the time. I'm obsessed, frankly. Conversely, the slider was bottom 10 among sliders in mistake minus non-competitive rate. There are a lot of, you know, you watch any of his starts or you look at the heat maps and there's a lot of sliders that just, you know, there's a big glob down, like way down and away, where it doesn't look like he either had the grip or the release wasn't good. And it wasn't, you know, poor location trying to attack a hitter, but it was just a full on non-competitive pitch. And so while I'm a little worried there, he threw enough last year that I'm pretty confident that he'll have the time to take the step forward. And he has such a strong floor with the fastball to be able to overcome it.
Yeah. I mean, I really hope that Eury does have just those breakers. It's so important. I love the fact that he still tried to make the changeup work against lefties and the strike rate did not get better. You know,
I didn't realize it was a 4% zone rate.
He's trying so hard. And I can't tell you how many times I watched games of his, especially earlier on in the season for him, where lefties would just fell off everything with the fastway, nothing else. So he's just trying to find some other look. And, oh, please just execute one changeup. It's just all these things. I just need to get this there. And he couldn't do it. And it's just, all right, another fastball. Let's hope he doesn't foul this one back, you know? That's the element with Eury that has me a little worried is where he also locates everything. It's not just that changeup or the breakers. It's the four-seamer not being elevated enough or along the edges. It's a lot of them just like, here you go. And I, you know, it's something that we talk about all the time. Okay, command comes back later with Tommy John, et cetera, et cetera. Very much so. He has not really had that full season that we want from him. So here it is. And my lesson that I keep telling myself and not listening to from this year is draft pitchers who have done it once before. who have just done it once, and all you're asking for them to do is do that thing again, instead of saying this is the year they're going to do the thing. And that innately has me at like 25 for Erie instead of top 20. And I so badly want to raise him higher, but that just keeps eating at me of just, he hasn't done it yet. And yet I can see why he didn't totally do it yet last year. So yeah. I hope he does.
It's definitely, you know, it's definitely a bit of a shot in the dark. But what I really like and what I think is underrated is that even through the struggles of this year, he had a 1.05 whip. And I think that goes so unnoticed a lot of the time, where you just see the ERA and, you know, strikeouts, innings and all of that in, you know, surface level fantasy stats. And, you know, even if he, you know, say takes a half step forward and ends at a 3.7 ERA, but still has that solid whip, that's going to do so much help for you in ways you probably won't ever realize. So,
there you go. And I also want to mention Michael King, Shane Bieber, Framber Valdez, Logan Webb, Shota Umanaga, Tyler Glasnow. They were all drafted earlier than Eury Pérez. I am not disagreeing with Nate's pick in the eighth after all of those guys went. It's about me drafting him appropriately. And if he was there in the ninth, I would have taken him. But he wasn't, because Nate Schwartz took him.
Yeah, I was between Snell and Pérez.
You take Erie, because Snell is, if you want to talk about anxiety.
Yeah.
Oh boy, let me show you the door. Matt Shaw is your ninth round pick. And I gotta ask some questions, Nate. What team are you a fan of?
The St. Louis Cardinals.
Yes. And what would you know about Matt Shaw?
He plays for the Chicago Cubs.
And he is a destroyer of the Cardinals. It is the thing. Oh, no, I'm thinking of Michael Bush. Okay, never mind. Not Matt Shaw. I'm thinking of Michael Bush. Am I thinking of Michael Bush?
Yes, you're thinking about Michael Bush.
I'm thinking of Michael Bush.
Michael Bush Stadium.
That is how little I know. He has a CH in the name, starts with an M, you know.
Close enough.
Yeah, so I just want to put on the table, you have not drafted any Cardinals at this moment.
This will be funny when we get to my later three picks in this draft, but I've had a pretty harsh rule of not drafting Cardinals when I play fantasy baseball, because if I have a player on my favorite team and they don't play well, who loses? Me, twice. Right. So I, you know, generally, if Matt Shaw hits three homers against the Cardinals in some small way, I have a victory. Matt Shaw, I was looking around at how just bleak third base is. I think second base has a lot quicker of a drop off at the top. And third base has some options. I know Austin Riley went in the seventh. I think Bregman, Michael Garcia are interesting kind of early middle round options. But I was kind of scrambling here of, I need something. And I really liked the changes that Matt Shaw made in the second half. I think he had like a 130 WRC plus and was on like a 25-15-ish pace in the second half. And, you know, for a rookie coming up who broke camp with the team, there was, you know, a lot of adjustment, a lot of questions and expectations for him. And it seems like he kind of quietly figured it out. And I'm happy to take the chance that, you know, even if he's a, you know, 110 WRC plus and goes 2015, I think I'm happy with what that would be for third base, given what was available.
Man, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know. Matt Shaw's process plus, Nate.
They don't love him. It doesn't
it's
love
an
him.
Atrocity.
Yeah.
He had, these are rolling charts, right? If you guys don't know this, this is, I think it's really funny. We have 20 million things, different ways to market PL Pro to you. Okay, of all the stuff that we offer, from the projections to my streaming rankings early to the Discord, which is the greatest thing ever, ad-free, blah, 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 blah. If I had to do one thing that you get one perk, it's access to our rolling charts with Process Plus. And this is showing me, I think it's one or maybe like 3 days of a 15-day window that Matt Shaw had a Process Plus above 100 for the entire season.
Yeah, it does not love them. I've got choice words for Kyle Bland.
Well, no, choice word for Matt Shaw and lack of power. Okay.
But he makes a lot of in zone contact, you know, not truly in the process plus that I think goes missed. And then just, you know, pulls enough in the air to make it all work. And I do think that, you know, he'll come into 2026 with a fresh slate. And I think, you know, a step forward would be nice, but if he was able to, you know, kind of repeat the coming above ground that we saw in the second half, I would be a fan of that.
Yeah, I hope so. And I think you really do hammer the point of like third base is bad now. Isaac Paredes, Matt Chapman, they go later in the ninth round. Royce Lewis is in the 13th. Wilde Marte in the 16th. I'm sure I'm missing one somewhere else that has dual eligibility. Yeah, it gets really rough. So
Shaw was the ninth third baseman off the board. So the bottom.
And what's really, really tough about this is you look at the pitchers who are still available, right? Like Drew Rasmussen was taken, and Cam Schlitter, Chase Burns, and Dylan Cease, and Nolan McLean, Ryan Pepiot. Like there are a number of starting pitchers who you know are going to help you, right?
Yeah.
Can you say with all certainty that you are not going to be dropping Matt Shaw by June 1st?
Absolutely not.
Right.
But and I felt like I had to scramble.
I'm not saying this is a bad pick.
Yeah.
What I am saying is my goal of a draft is to draft guys I know I'm holding on to as much as I can and not to be in a position of having to take a Matt Shaw. Watch Matt Shaw's going to have an amazing season, though. You know, like, what do I know about hitters?
Well, as a Cardinal fan, I hope not.
But Matt Shaw is your ninth round pick. Anything, any other words you want to share on him?
Nope. I would like to talk about my 10th round pick.
Because Kershaw's gone now, right? Nolan McLean, the 10th. And Nolan McLean, I got to say, is one of those guys who is getting propped up a lot early on. And I'm curious what your take is. I think that this is relatively where the dust is going to settle because this is later than I believe the NFBC ADP has for Nolan McLean. It has him after Burns and Schlitter, for example, who I think are not actually perceived as better than McLean. Where are you on McLean after just 8 starts in the bigs?
I'm really, really high on him. You know, of that, I think Eno referred to it as the, you know, Majestic 7, the Hype 7, or whatever
it was. Seven, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I love and that. When we did this draft, I was like, I'm happy to get McLean here. And then was shocked to find out a couple of weeks later that he was the first second-year pitcher off the board by a, you know, decently healthy margin.
Save Jacob Mizorowski, or is that actually including?
I think McLean was above Mizorowski.
Oh, man.
Because you had the kind of late season and playoff struggles for Mizorowski.
Okay.
Or I don't remember if he struggled in the playoffs, but right. I know there was some hesitancy. Sure. But I really feel that McLean is, you know, really polished, and the fact that he has the ability to get right-handed hitters out seemingly at ease gives him the platform to tinker with and find an approach for lefties. It's one of those things where, you know, we saw it with Brian Wu early in his career where he struggled to get lefties out and eventually, you know, it clicked. And I know they're not the same archetype necessarily, but I think there's just a lot of opportunity. And while he is the sinker sweeper guy who, you know, generally you'd perceive those guys as more inning eaters, you know, good ratios, not great strikeouts. We've seen the strikeout games from him where I think he just has an opportunity really to blossom. And the innings look to be in a really strong position. So I think, you know, I think he's in a really good position, even if he doesn't have lefties perfectly figured out, you know, this year.
So if you want to know more about Nolan McLean and my take on him, you got to go listen to the On the Corner podcast with Eric Samolsky, where we talk about finding a top 25 starting pitcher. But I will tell you, I am not going to be drafting Nolan McLean next year. And I'm not as confident in his Nate. But Nate's really smart. So it's good to have two opinions here, guys. The main pushback I have is just that I don't think his fastballs are that good. I think they overperformed in the small sample. Sweeper didn't miss enough bats. And yeah, that is a problem against lefties. You're right that Brian Wu came through with it, but it is always easier to come through when your fastball is your best asset. The biggest weakness we see with failure against lefties is fastballs not being good enough. That means you have to squeeze more and more out with secondaries. That's a harder thing to do than the reverse. That is the crux of it.
Yeah, I think for him that I'm really interested to see is how he adjusts the sweeper usage versus lefties. Because he threw it like 20, 21% of the time to lefties, which feels very counterintuitive. And I think he's got real potential in the cutter to lefties.
Now you're speaking my language there, Nate. Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Aren't you the anti-cutter guy? I'm sorry. He is not. That's an inside joke.
I love cutters.
All right. He doesn't. But
it's a pitch he can throw in the zone to lefties. He gets strikes with it. You know, it's pretty league average in terms of ideal contact rate. But I think it's kind of the thing that if he throws it more and stops throwing a sweeper 20% of the times to opposite-handed hitters, I think that could be a big step towards him figuring it out.
All right. Well, we're going to move on here to the 11th round. And we will do that after this break. So it's Will Smith, World Series hero for the Dodgers as your catcher in the 11th round. I feel like this is fantastic value for your catcher.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the draft, one of my big takeaways was that this is the year of the catcher. There were so many options still on the board and, you know, all throughout the draft that were like, there are just so many good catchers. And that felt like a perfect opportunity to go with Old Reliable. Too many guys were, you know, oh, they want to chase the next big thing and whatever. Will Smith posted his best season by WRC plus by like 20% this year. Like he hit 296 and was just, you know, incredible when he was playing. And I don't see why I wouldn't go chase this. You know, it's Old Reliable. You know what you're getting. And he's going to be, I think, phenomenal. To get him in the 11th. And I think some of the other catching options that might've gone earlier, you know, might not work out that well.
Yeah. I mean, it's look, there are going to be a lot of different opinions on catcher. Go for Cal Raleigh early, go for this middle crew, William Contreras, Shailen Lears, Hunter Goodman, Ben Rice, Augustin Ramirez, Ivan Herrera, Will Smith. Or you wait and you get Salvador Perez in the 19th, Yainer Diaz, Alejandro Kirk, Drake Baldwin, Samuel Basalo. Honestly, all of them make sense to me. Take your pick. And I just couldn't help Ben Rice. I just think he's incredible.
I loved the Ben Rice pick.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes. I didn't know how I felt. So
It was one of my favorite.
Surprise!
In that middle grouping. But yeah, I just, you know, he's Old Reliable. This was almost getting him at a discount because I know
Will
he was
Smith.
Was pushed up a bit last year, and I'll gladly take him at the slight discount.
Sure. Now, here's a funny thing. Nate doesn't know this, guys. I saw Nate's draft, and I decided I was going to make some phone calls, and I decided to call the Red Sox and said, "Look, my guy Nate has too many Cardinals on his team. Can you please go and trade for one of them?" So fine. Okay. They traded for Sonny Gray. So look, Nate, you didn't even draft a Cardinal. Sonny Gray in the 12th round. He's a Red Sox.
My draft is aging beautifully. I'm getting the Cardinals actually off of my roster.
So Sonny Gray is a very interesting one in my book. I think we can talk about him in a couple ways. I think it hurts him personally going to Boston. Even though the win total should get better, I think the environment in Busch and also the team around him is just a better context for success than it is in Boston. I think he'll get the hook a little bit earlier there. I don't know how I feel about the defense. And yeah, it's just, I don't feel as good about it. I'm curious what your thoughts are from Sonny Gray going from St. Louis to Boston.
Yeah, one thing I noticed was a lot of the hard contact he gave up, especially against righties, was getting out and really falling in Busch Stadium in right center field. And I think it's interesting that Fenway and the full center and right field defense they have with Willy Abreu and either Roman Anthony or whoever is patrolling center, I think will be, you know, still really beneficial and more things might stay in the park for him. But what I think is most interesting about him going to Boston is that I think they're going to get him to move on from his backdoor sinker obsession. He threw it too much.
That's interesting. Because he had, what was it in 2024? It was like a 40% put away rate.
Yep.
With that backdoor sinker. And that fell. Not absurdly. I think it went down to like 27, if I remember correctly. But it's still, why do you want them to go away from the backdoor sinker for Sonny Gray?
It's just he was throwing so much in the zone. And that is something that is so susceptible to balls in play and two strikes, in two strike counts. You know, he's got all of these breaking pitches, throw the breaking pitches, get the whiff. You don't need to freeze the guy. And it's such a, we saw, as you mentioned, in 2024, it was a 40% put away rate. And that is such a high bar for it to succeed. So when it drops to 31% in 25, which is still 93rd percentile, he really struggles. And I think kind of going off that, he just threw the pitch in the zone a bunch more. And I think that negatively, you know, affected the output because, you know, he works best when he's confusing hitters and when you rely on something too much without, you know, great stuff, you can get harmed, you know, pretty significantly, even when the, you know, the stats are pretty good.
Yeah. It's, so the ball and play percentage was 22% last year for the sinker. Against right-handers, and in the year before it was 17%, so it did get put into play more often. Still 31% put away rate is 93rd percentile on sinkers, which is pretty fantastic. Maybe that could be, I mean, you're right, it did get worse against right-handers, and that is an issue that can be fixed by just not doing it as much. But I wonder if he is still going to lean on it. I mean, sweeper was used 2/3 of the time in two strike counts against right-handers. Like, he did save that one for them, and that was 23% usage overall against right-handers. So that was really the first option, I think, against righties for the punch out. But yeah, I can see where you come from with that. And Sonny Gray is going to be a guy that is going to go through stretches of feeling it or not. And he certainly had more bouts of failure this past year with a 4.28 ERA and a 1.23 WHIP. As the home runs did go a little bit higher, but really it was the hit rate going to 9.2 instead of the routine 7 and change that he's had prior, which obviously should get better. That's really everything that you look at. That's the problem. Strikeout rate did come down as we expected, but didn't go down as much as I thought it would. And I would put that with, against lefties, the coolest asset I would say from 2024 was a 31% put away rate and 27% on his sweeper. So sweeper's 27, curveball was 30 against lefties. I apologize. I'm doing the Bernie Sanders now, where I wave my hand in front of my face as I explain. And those actually got better in 2025 against lefties. 31% sweeper put away rate, 37% on curveballs. And I really want to put this into perspective. Put away rate is like 22-23% is what we expect for secondary pitches often. If it gets up to 25 to 30, whoa, oh my gosh. To see 37% with this curveball, 31% on the sweeper to lefties, that's huge. And he threw that curveball overall 25% of the time to lefties. So it's he's got a good feel for that, and that's why you see the strikeout rate still up. It's a rare feat, really. So it's more believable now after that 27%, of course, that you could keep that up. And the hit rate should come down. So maybe there is something here.
Yeah, it's also kind of, you know, when I was looking at who was available, it really feels like just a strong strikeout minus walk rate play of I'm going to trust that. And he's, even now, you know, I didn't know at the time, but he's going to a really smart pitching organization. He's a tinkerer that, you know, I really think he's going to, you know, ideally make the changes necessary to maintain that, and then see, you know, even if the ERA isn't, you know, exceptional like it's been in the years past, if he could get down to 3.7, 3.8, I think I'll be happy with this pick.
So that was Sonny Gray there in the 12th round. We got to speed up a little bit. This is all my fault. Mike Trout, 13th. You're like, hey, what the heck? When he's healthy, he's still Mike Trout.
Exactly. You know, Process Plus still loves him. It's a 123 Process Plus, despite a 79 contact. So, like, maybe there's a
close. He's on a 79?
Yeah. It was a 30-something percent strikeout rate. But I know when he's healthy, he's going to be in my lineup and producing in some ways. I could see him doing the Stanton 2025 season in minimal games, man. And I'll be happy.
Is he like the quietest goat ever?
Yes. You know? Absolutely.
You know, my nephew, I think when he was like 4 years old, came to Cape Cod, and I remember saying, hey, Liam, we're not going to go get ice cream unless you understand this truth. Who is the best baseball player? And I have him on camera saying Mike Trout, right? And you know, he's nine now. So this was like, he's about to turn. So I guess it was like 2019 or so, that summer or something like that. And it's so quick. It just goes away.
Yeah.
You know, it was so long. It's Mike Trout. We know this. Oh, man. But yeah, I mean, 13th round, 12 teamer. I say this constantly. Get guys who are really good and their only problem is health, because great, you have a best in slot in a 12 teamer for whenever they're healthy. That is way more valuable than the guy goes through the entire year, because the replacement value is much higher. So big fan of that one. Seal of approval, 13th round, Mike Trout. I don't care what anyone says. Ryan Helsley, 14th round, also seal of approval. This is not a Cardinal.
I drafted this knowing he was not going to be a Cardinal.
I know. Well, he was already traded to the Mets. So, yes. And they weren't going to sign him. It's just, it's funny how you cheated yourself almost.
Yes. I've drafted two Cardinal non-Cardinals.
It's like you're playing chess against yourself. You're like, he's going to go here. I'll be able to go around, you know.
Yeah. But the thing about Helsley that I guess is kind of, you know, I don't want to say insider information of being a Cardinals fan, but what I experienced in prior years was that he already had undergone some tipping issues that he was able to solve. And he also really struggled in trying to do four out saves with the Cardinals or before he was the closer, you know, in leverage non-save situations. So I knew he was going to get an opportunity to close somewhere. And, you know, I absolutely am confident that he's going to be able to figure out the issues that were plaguing him. And I think he's going to be lights out in Baltimore.
Ooh-wee. All right. I mean, I think it's a great pick getting a great closer in the 14th. Like, this always happens. This always happens. That's such a good one. I know he's not going to start. He shouldn't have started. The whole thing about him starting, I don't stop that. Look at this. We got Jacob Mossy. I will say that every single time to my grave, and I don't care if y'all are sick of it. I will do the Jason Marquis joke forever. And so you got Jacob Mossy in the 15th round. How do you feel about him? He's a Process Plus darling.
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of my thinking with this pick. There was really a bunch of relievers and kind of fringe starters going around here, and I didn't really like any of the options kind of bat-wise, and I thought it was a really fun pick. I mean, Process Plus loves him. He doesn't really chase. He makes a lot of contact and has shown a sneaky amount of pop, and that's absolutely an archetype I'm chasing. And I think, you know, this late, you know, I don't think the average at 292 is going to stick, but if he hits 275, I think I'm absolutely happy with, you know, how he produces.
And guess what? He's already hitting first, second, third in the Miami lineup. And I know it's not as good of a lineup, but that could be 80 runs, 80 RBI if he's just always there. Yeah. So that works. That is very good for your 15th round. Do I want to give that a seal of approval? No. Okay. Peyton Tolley. In the 16th round, this is an interesting one because when you look at the Red Sox rotation, even before the Sonny Gray deal, it didn't quite add up that Peyton Tolley would be in the rotation. And Connelly Early went in the next round as someone I think I personally believe the Red Sox are giving an inside track to over Tolley for a potential spot. But you went Tolley instead, and I wanted you to outline your thoughts behind this pick.
Yeah, I mean, similar to with Eury Pérez, I really love the fastball.
Yeah, it's
like it just rocks, and I think, you know, maybe it's, you know, a little aggressive, as I agree, you know, kind of looking back on it. I don't know if he has the inside track on the rotation, but he will get starts. And I think over a full season, he does have the skill set to outperform Connelly Early. And I really think, you know, if he's given that opportunity again, I could see him taking it and not looking back. And you have a full offseason, spring training and stuff of, you know, working with and being around Garrett Crochet, who's also a somewhat similar power lefty.
It is a huge benefit because you saw Garrett Crochet with just really a fastball.
Yeah.
And then turning himself into using the cutter and finding the sweeper and then adding the sinker. And we hope that's what Peyton Tolley will do over time. So I'm with you. The best pitch between Early and Tolley belongs to Tolley. But there isn't enough there while Connelly Early has more of an arsenal, I think, at the moment. Yeah. And Connelly Early is my favorite late round starter target as of now. It is kind of interesting how I really just like that guy. But Peyton Tolley, it's such a good heater. If he does get a cutter really working, that can be very dangerous there. If you did this again, would you be taking Peyton Tolley in the 16th?
I don't think so.
Who would you be taking instead?
I think I was, my queue was decimated before. I was looking at Ryan Nelson, Shane McClanahan, and Andrew Abbott. And I think Abbott had gone maybe two rounds.
Abbott went in the 15th and Nelson the 16th and McClanahan taken by some dunce in the that round. And all three of them were after your previous pick.
Yeah, I think looking back on it, I would have gone with Early there, but I just wanted something a little bit exciting.
That makes sense. I would have gone with Nathan Eovaldi, but now that I see it, I'm like, Eovaldi.
Yeah.
But no, it's something to think about. And the second that Peyton Tolley starts again, we're all going to be picking him up in our 12 teamers. Willy Adames in the 17th. So yeah. You have Jeremy Peña, but Willy Adames, what, he hit 31 home runs or something?
Yeah.
Wild, right?
Like, yeah.
The second half that was glorious, or at least it came out of nowhere, I think, all of a sudden.
Oh, yeah. He was really struggling, hitting under 200 early in the year.
Oof. He didn't get too much higher by the end.
But he is someone who I think it took a little bit for him to adapt to his new ballpark, especially one that, you know, hates right-handed hitters as much as San Francisco does, and he still hit 30 home runs. And I think one thing that I noticed as I was doing my build outside of the Mike Trout pick, I'd taken a lot of guys who, you know, showed some stolen base, some power, you know, Jeremy Peña, Matt Shaw, Wyatt Langford, guys who, you know, there was a little bit of a half and half. It wasn't all power, all speed. And I wanted to just add kind of a fringe later bat who is going to post a bunch of homers and I don't really have to worry about it.
Sure. It makes all the sense too. And Adames is one of those guys that, like, 12 teamers, who knows when he's going to have his hot streak and his cold streak. So it could be the hot streak right away and that would be awesome, you know, and then you feel great, you know? So it's one of those where I'd rather take this kind of guy than your 15-15. Because the 15-15 it's less than a stolen base and a home run a week.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a grind. Matthew Liberatore, 18th round. Look at this.
First real Cardinal.
Resist.
No, I could not. I think the biggest thing with Liberatore, was that he really fell off a cliff with fatigue. This was his first real year starting. He had been really back and forth. The Cardinals did not want to give him a starting role until this year, almost kind of out of necessity. And he was great, or, you know, good enough for the first two and a half months, and it completely cratered. And he was still able to get to 150 innings this year. And I think with the full off season of knowing, you know, what that took, I think he'll come back and be able to, you know, one, make it through the season. But for a pitcher in the 18th round, I don't think that's, you know, necessarily the most important part. I think I saw enough from the cutter and the slider that I think it can all work to be a good ratios play. And having taken Tolley, who, you know, two rounds prior, who had a lot of questions on innings and role, I kind of wanted to make sure I got a guy who was exciting to some extent, but more importantly, had a had an innings, you know, base.
But the thing is, he's not one to swatch. He doesn't.
No, he is not a swatch.
Tight changeup.
No, it is an awful changeup.
And that bothers me. I'm sorry. If you're a crafty lefty, right? Like Liberatore is, because he's not an overpowering one.
No.
To not have a tight changeup is just antithetical almost.
He reminds me
what he's trying to do. But as you said, you're right of, hey, cool. This cutter getting inside to righties has got to be that slider away to lefties has to be there. Good enough command with the fastball. We saw it a lot this year. It is a good situation in St. Louis. However, I would argue that there is a free agent pitcher who's going to sign with the Cardinals that was very much available in this draft, who is going to be so much better. It's what you want Matthew Liberatore to be. That is Merrill Kelly. He is going to sign with the Cardinals. It's just, it's a done deal. Okay. You heard it here first. I have no sources, guys, but it just, it's one of those matches made in heaven. Merrill Kelly, your boring ideal of Miles Michaelis. Obviously, he's going to St. Louis when they'll sign him in like a 3-year deal and he'll be happy or so. 3-4 years, $60 million, call it a day. And that's it.
Yeah,
how would you feel about that, Nate?
I'd be happy. I don't think people are ready for how many left-handed pitchers are about to show up in St. Louis.
Oh, man, you're right. Yeah, you have Quinn Matthews as well.
Quinn Matthews, Cooper Jerpy, Liam Doyle, they're coming.
Oh, man, at least we got Tinkham.
As a left-handed pitcher growing up and a left-handed enthusiast.
And you are a, by the way, we're in a first pitch Arizona. I don't know what you're doing. But you might have seen Nate Schwartz throw in the pitch box, or whatever you want to call it, the pitching cage, with throwing at the numbers. And Nate's delivery, I'm a little jealous of. he kind of has a, it reminds me of Robert Gasser.
Yep.
It's kind of flat. It's shorter to the ribs than some. And he whips it.
Yeah.
It was the funniest thing. And I'm very jealous that you're a lefty.
But, you know, completely conversely to that with Liberatore, he's the Kershaw archetype. Not saying he's in any way performance related, but nowhere close. They just are left-handed. But a pretty over-the-top lefty, obvious, like, who's focused on the fastball, the curveball, and then the breaking pitches. He doesn't have the changeup, and Liberatore will likely never have the changeup. And as we see with Kershaw, it is such a high bar of execution to figure it out. And I think that's what we've seen with Liberatore as a highly regarded prospect. But that's the archetype I see, you know, as, you know, almost a what could be in terms of at least any bit of ceiling.
So Drew Pomeranz, Drew Smiley, Matthew Liberatore.
Exactly.
Archetype. Was just the, then there's also Kershaw, whatever. But like,
a man can dream.
Keeping it more. Gotcha. We're going to talk about your last five picks very quickly here. Actually, you're probably in roughly 10 minutes or so. But before we do, got to take one more break. All right, Nate, how do you feel about your 19th round pick in this
draft? It got interesting.
It got interesting because he was no longer an Oriole. He's an Angel. That is Grayson Rodriguez. And did you know the Angels had over a negative 50 outs above average last year as a team defense? And that doesn't really matter. It's just, are you going to be healthy? Grayson Rodriguez, you thought 19th round, what the heck? Take a shot.
Yeah. I mean, I think we'll know pretty quickly with him. Because the reports were, as he was, you know, coming back, not coming back from injury, that he was throwing a little bit. And, you know, we've seen that he's able to miss bats. And, you know, I think the ERA, especially with that horrid defense, will be, you know, a question. But it's the Angels. They're going to let him throw. And, you know, if he shows any semblance of being like the even the 2023 version of Grayson Rodriguez, I think it's, you know, perfectly worth the flyer to take here this late.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is the kind of thing, again, I encourage all the time later on. It's hard to find something that you're going to necessarily hold at this point. Might as well just go for an injured thing that you'd quickly get rid of. So seal of approval there for Grayson Rodriguez. I know that sounds shocking, but like, yes, this is exactly the kind of pick you should be making. Ryan Weathers in the 20th. That's a fun one. Talk to me about that one.
I think it was important that we saw him come back at the end of the year. And this is another, you know, we'll know pretty early, is the fastball velocity there. When it shows up, it works really well for him. I don't know if the changeup is really good enough to be a secondary throughout the full season, but we've seen glimpses of, you know, an exciting arsenal from Weathers. And, you know, he's probably, I think when I was looking earlier, there's a good chance that I'll go in that first weekend for the Marlins, and I'll take my chance with that.
Yeah, he is a swatch. His changeup got much better over the years. 21% swing strike rate in both 24 and 25 for Ryan Weathers. And his velocity did go up to 97 on average, and 96 last year, 95 before that. Did you know that Ryan Weathers has third percentile extension? 5.9. Not good. Not what you want to see, which does mean that 97 maybe comes in more at 95, but still, that's from the left side. You have a good changeup off of the sweeper. He is very interesting. The one reason why I personally haven't circled and said, yes, I am going to do this, is because we constantly just don't see Ryan Weathers stay on the field long enough to do it, or do the thing long enough. And I hate to make a Weathers joke, but yeah, it's, you know, it is like the weather. You know, we don't know what we're going to get every day necessarily, at least throughout a full season. So I do have some hesitancy of leaning into it. However, at this point in your 12 teamer, Ryan Weathers absolutely would have been drafted by yours truly if he were around in the 22nd, 23rd, because what the heck? Let's just see what we got. And he's not going to be going as the SP5 for the Marlins. If he is healthy and he's just going out of camp, he's going to be going that opening weekend. And I am so in on that. Draft everyone in the first three slots of rotations. That is, do not go after SP5s, because you'll be waiting longer and longer and longer. They're also not sure things. The organizations are more tepid on them. They won't go longer into games, etc. It's just a good general rule that obviously there are always exceptions. That's one of my five mantras. There are always exceptions. But Ryan Weathers is not one of those. He is going to be early in that rotation. You're going to know opening weekend, quickly be able to make that choice. I like this pick too. This is a fun one. I would take him over Landon Roop. I would take him over not Seth Lugo. Parker Messick probably. Chad Patrick, Reese Olson, Bryden Baio. Maybe not Reese Olson. I don't know. It's a very interesting crew at the bottom. Spencer already Getty here too. Lugo and Kelly. It's all interesting stuff. But yeah, I like this one with Ryan Weathers. He should be drafted around them. Helio Ramos.
Yeah.
Ooh, this guy.
I mean, kind of bounce back season you're looking at. His barrel rate dropped pretty precipitously year over year. But, you know, Process Plus still liked him a decent amount. And he still, you know, maybe better for roto leagues of going 250 and 20 homers in, you know, more or less a very boring way. But, you know, I'll take the shot that he, you know, maybe bounces back to that 2023 level, or rather 2024 level, and has a good start to the season. The one interesting thing here was he set a new max EV by like 3 miles an hour last year.
Ooh.
Which, you know, we didn't see it in the results at all, but that felt pretty notable. And for a 21st round player that, you know, more often than not is immediately swapped out within that first week, I'll take a shot.
Yeah, I understand that completely. We don't know how the lineup will shape up for the Giants, but he was batting first and second and third for most of the season. And by the end, it was at the top of the lineup. So that's really nice for Eloy Ramos. Getting that consistent production that's pretty dang cool. Getting that in the 21st round of just having that guy that you can swap in. I totally understand it. Chad Patrick in the 22nd round. First of all, two first names, so no. But is he going to properly start? Are they going to let him do it? It is a case where it feels like the Brewers, and they've done this with the guys in the past, are content to say just five innings from certain guys. Do you think that Chad Patrick is one of them, or do you think that they are going to let him go a full six?
I think it really hinges on where Freddy Peralta is. Because I think if he moves and Patrick ends up as the SP 3 or 4, and you know that's with questions to Brandon Woodruff health-wise, I think they're going to need innings from him. And I really like, obviously, the Brewers' pitching development, and I just love the Triforce that he has. He doesn't have anything else, but it's a really fun cutter, and the sinker and four seam do enough in the periphery to make it work.
Oh man, you might be too young for this, Nate, but I don't know if you remember Alex Fast talking about the Imperial Shuttle.
No.
That was the same concept. I call it the diamond of four of them if you have a changeup in there, or you have a curveball in there actually. But yeah, having four different directions in that way, or the three would be the Imperial Shuttle. And I like that you call the Triforce too. That's where my mind goes.
Yeah.
So that's shout out Alex Fast there. But yes, Freddy Peralta, Brandon Woodruff, Jacob Mizorowski, Quinn Priester, Chad Patrick is the current expected 1 through 5 for the Brewers. But if Peralta does get dealt, or the Brewers could easily just add a free agent and think, cool, we have two options left with Chad Patrick. He was in this role last year. He did great. We feel comfortable adding someone else and then bringing up Patrick when we need some help. That could be what happens too.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely up in the air. Is kind of, he was one of the last guys on the board that I was like, this is a fun option that I'm pretty intrigued by. And when I was looking into it, I was like, it wouldn't surprise me if a Brewers pitcher out of nowhere showed up with a whiff pitch and he just became like, you know, something more. It would be a very Brewers thing to do. And you know, I liked enough of it already that I'll take the shot.
What is interesting is that none of Chad Patrick's pitches are above a 5 PLV, including the cutter. And when you see a starting pitcher feature a cutter as their primary offering, 41% from Chad Patrick, it usually returns something like a ridiculous PLV. Mitch Spence, you have Drew Rasmussen in that conversation, and 494 for Chad Patrick's, but 15% swing strike rate, 68% strike rate on it. It was still a very good pitch for him. So, yeah, it is fun that you have this guy that is able to do so well with a cutter. And also a four-seamer that gets a 13% swing strike rate is able to mask the two effectively upstairs. But yeah, he does need something else. He does need something that goes down properly, right? Or really lives low properly. The cutter at 88 versus the 94 four-seamer kind of is a slider. It's really in that gray area of what is a cutter and what is a slider that drives Eno Saris crazy. That's what, the fourth counter, I want to say, for shouting Eno's name in this podcast. But yeah, he is a very interesting one. I would say that he's not quite the kind of guy I like going for in this, because as an SP5, if you're an SP5, then it needs to be something worthwhile in a big way if he is in that rotation and doing it, right? So, I mean, not to say that there is someone else to go for here. Like, I was running out so much, I had Andrew Painter in the 22nd round, okay? All right? But, and like, really, there's nothing. It's Clay Holmes, Casey Mize, Brandon Sproat, Kyle Harrison, and my boy Sawyer Gibson Long. But it does kind of showcase, it does shrivel up a little bit by the end. It does,
yeah.
You do get fewer options.
I did notice at the end there, because I think last year there were a lot of kind of last three round options that I liked a lot more. And here it really, you know, rounds 17 through 20 or so. That's when you need to get your guys in terms of, you know, pitchers with question marks.
Yeah, it's not as clear yet, but let me tell you, spring training. Oh, we do have some fun things that happen there every single year. So strapping for that one. And what do you know, 23rd round, you're like, I have one Cardinal, because I know that Sonny Gray is going to get traded and Nick told me what he's doing. So why not? Alec Burleson, I need another Cardinal here.
Who let me draft all the Cardinals? I want to know. No, I really think he's an underrated average guy. I think my hot take is Burleson, like every other Cardinal I drafted, won't be playing for the Cardinals come opening day. I think he could end up in somewhere like Seattle, or actually no, because they signed Naylor. But I think he could end up not on the Cardinals, and he's going to hit, you know, 280, 290. And I really like that, again, as a kind of fringe bench option, see how he does early on and gives me an opportunity to chase something else later.
There you go. Well, Nate Schwartz, that is your mock draft. On a scale of 1 to 23, how do you feel about this team?
About a 17 or 18.
Okay.
I really liked how I started the draft. I mean, I don't think Soto and Crochet will be a combination you'll see very much come January 1st yeah. through actual draft day, and add Ketel Marte onto that. And I think that's, you know, as good as any three rounds can go. And I liked my mid-early round selections, but then I think I maybe got a little bit too ambitious later in the draft. But all in all, I know as a manager, I make a lot of moves and I can, you know, parse through that pretty quickly. But I think I definitely left something to be desired, through and through at the end.
And is there something that you learned in this draft that you're going to take with you in March?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is to understand how pitching volume goes. I think this draft really went in pockets of stuff guys getting drafted together and innings guys getting drafted together. And I really want to make sure, you know, I think it's very easy to identify, you know, pitcher tiers or position tiers, but within that, especially with pitching, really know, you know, where are the innings and ratio drop-offs, because that is just so, so important, you know, across the entire season.
Definitely. Well, that's it. That's Nate Schwartz, everyone, with his mock drafts. Nate, can't thank you enough for joining us today and participating in this one. That's going to do for this episode. We will also have Kyle Bland's mock draft shortly after this one. But that is it for today. So on behalf of Nate Schwartz, my name is Nick Pollock, and we'll enjoy On the Corner again next week.